Good, how are you?
Great.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order on this fine January 12th, 2018. Committee members and members of the public listening, we're going to have an informational meeting today to go over some of the concepts that we expect to see in this committee in the upcoming session. And with that, I think I'll go ahead and open the informational meeting, and we're going to start with a discussion of the resulting proposal for 2018 on the PERS UAL task force. Shouldn't be using those acronyms, I guess. The Public Employee Retirement System Unfunded Actuarial Liability Task Force. So with that, I'm going to bring, would like to invite up Ilana Pertle-Guinney and her task force member, Corey Streisinger. Good afternoon. Glad to see you here on a Friday.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Holvey and members of the committee for having us. For the record, my name is Ilana Pertle-Guinney. I am the governor's workforce and labor policy advisor. The 2017 legislative session where the Senate Workforce Committee had a robust conversation about the public employee retirement system and a variety of potential reforms to that system, changes to the system, ways to pay it down, ways to put more money into the system. The governor was left with the strong belief that the next step we need to take as it relates to our public employee retirement system is looking for ways to get more money into the system to pay down the unfunded actuarial liability relatively quickly. But with that belief in mind, the governor convened a task force of majority business leaders in our state, as well as a number of individuals who have extensive experience with budgeting in the public sector, and asked them to look for any way that we could use our public dollars in a better way to free up resources to pay down the unfunded actuarial liability. What I'd like to do today is allow Corey Streisinger, who was a member of that task force, to update you all on the work of the task force. You have their final report in front of you. And then I will come back and run through a short PowerPoint talking about what the governor took from the task force report and what we'll be bringing forward in the 2018 session as a bill from the work of the task force.
Great. And before we get started, committee members, it would be my preference that we wait till the end to ask questions. So keep track of your questions, write them down, because if we allow questions during this presentation, it'll get disjointed, won't make as much sense, and we won't be out of here in time. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, and as Ilana said, I did serve as a member of the governor's task force on the PERS unfunded actuarial liability. Our task force was specifically charged by the governor with coming up with $5 billion that could be used to pay down that unfunded liability. There were a few topics that the governor took off the table in doing our work. For example, she asked us not to propose selling any state parks. She said, don't get into the revenue system and major tax reform. And we were also asked not to look at the structure and benefits of the PERS system. We were told those discussions would happen elsewhere. But with those few exceptions, we were asked to look pretty broadly and come up with whatever ideas we could that could be used to help solve this problem. The task force consisted of 7 people, as Ilana said, a majority from the private sector, 4 business leaders, and 3 with experience at different levels of the public sector. I was one of those 3 as a former head of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and also former general counsel for the Port of Portland. Although we were not subject to the public meetings law, our meetings were held and most of our discussions were held in public. We also had a process for accepting public input and comment. Early on in our process, we came up with some broad principles that then guided our work. First, we decided not to attempt to make a specific set of recommendations, but rather to come up with a list of options. And what I mean by that is we did not try to come up with items that everybody on the task force specifically agreed with or would themselves recommend. We felt that that was a decision for others to make, and that what we wanted to do, the screen that we applied, was we wanted to come up with a menu of options that we felt weren't unreasonable and that policymakers could then consider. The flip side of that, of course, is that options that we thought were unreasonable or did not make sense, we did not put forward. An example of that would be a proposal to sell and lease back state buildings, which would generate cash up front, but our analysis showed would simply be more costly in the long run, and we didn't see that that type of approach made sense. We decided that it was not up to us to evaluate the political feasibility of the options that we put forward, which was a very freeing concept, I will say. We felt that those, again, would be decisions for you and for the governor to make. And finally, in the limited time that we had available, we were not able to fully evaluate all of the options that we discussed. We included those that we believed, based on the analysis that we had been able to do, were worth further consideration, and we tried to identify the issues and areas that we thought would need further study in order to take them forward. Because PERS affects government employers at all levels, we looked for options at all levels, cities and counties, school districts and special districts, the university system, the public corporations, and, of course, state government. Each task force member took on specific assignments relating to different issues and different levels of government. We met with people with expertise in those areas and people with ideas to offer to come up with concepts and to come up with information about those concepts. And then each task force member prepared concept papers to bring to the full task force. And you will find those specific concept papers in the appendices to the report that you have in front of you. In each case, we tried to identify the potential financial implications, that is, the amount of cash that could be generated for the UAL. In some cases, we were able to do that with more precision. In other cases, the amounts were unknown. And what the governor had asked us to do, incidentally, was to look at a five-year time frame for that $5 billion. And as I mentioned, in each case, we also tried to identify what the key policy considerations would be if each particular option were implemented. Because there's such a wide range of local governments and situations faced by each PERS employer, we didn't attempt to come up with a prescriptive list applicable to local governments. The approach we took instead at the local government level was to identify a range of options that many local governments might want to consider. We proposed that each local government be asked to come up with a plan specific to its own circumstances and its own share of the unfunded actuarial liability. And we also propose that the state consider setting up an incentive fund so that local government contributions to the unfunded actuarial liability would be matched at some level as an incentive for local governments to go forward. At the state level, we identified a number of more concrete options that could be used to set up the matching fund, but could also be used to pay down the unfunded actuarial liability directly. And again, you'll see those in the report. I'm not planning to go through the specific list, but in general, we looked for windfall revenue. We looked for other one-time or variable revenue amounts where the excess over some baseline might be suitable to be used for the unfunded actuarial liability. We looked for anticipated revenue increases that had not yet been allocated to specific uses that could, again, potentially be allocated to the UAL. We looked at underutilized assets that could be either sold or changed to generate additional revenue, and we looked at existing cash reserves that potentially could be tapped for this purpose. We certainly acknowledge that many of the options we identify involve some significant public policy trade-offs, and we know that finding solutions will not be easy, but we do hope that the menu of options that we put forward will be useful to you and to the governor as you attempt to wrestle with this problem. So I'll be happy to take questions, I guess, after Alana's presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and again, for the record, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Ilana Pirtle-Ginney here on behalf of the governor. I want to run through a broader picture of what the governor's plan is around the public employee retirement system to place the bill that we'll be bringing in 2018 into context, run through a few slides about why we are tackling the piece of PERS, the unfunded actuarial liability that bill relates to now, and then talk about the pieces of the bill. So in 2017, coming out of the legislative session, the governor worked with the treasurer's office to secure internal investment officers. We have seen over a number of years that the internal investment officers within the treasurer's office are able to secure reliably strong returns for the funds, and the treasurer and the governor both felt like the system would be better served if we were able to shift the balance a little bit more toward those internal officers as opposed to the external contracted investment folks across the country. Following the legislative session, as the PERS board was looking at moving funds out of their reserves, often those funds are split between a number of accounts. The governor directed the PERS board to put all excess reserves and investments directly toward paying down the unfunded actuarial liability. That secured about $500 million to that end. We also directed the PERS board to look at ways to make side accounts more accessible. Side accounts are a tool that PERS employers can use to offset future PERS rates, future employer rates. And traditionally, those accounts were opened when an employer took out a pension obligation bond. They would then deposit the dollars there and hope that with the interest earned, they ended up ahead compared to the interest they paid on the bond. The requirements to open an account were such that it was difficult to do so with small amounts of dollars. It was really only feasible if you had a large chunk of money from something like bonding. The PERS board in December finalized decision-making that will allow employers with much smaller amounts of money to deposit funds within PERS to be invested alongside the PERS account and offset their future employer rates. We also directed the agency to ensure that every employer has a better understanding not only of their own rates into the future, but also the effect of side accounts on their rates in the future. And PERS has released a tool that is now available to all employers to plug in just a few numbers that they should already have in their PERS reports to get a better sense of what their liabilities will be into the future. Finally, the governor worked with our state employees to obtain agreement by the vast majority of state workers to contribute to their own PERS accounts through the payments to the IAP. In 2018, we're bringing a bill forward that has two main focuses, both related to the unfunded actuarial liability. The first is to find funds with which to create a side account for schools, and I'll talk a little bit later about why the governor's focus is mainly on the K-12 community, and then also create an employer incentive fund and look for ways to help all PERS employers address their increasing employer costs. Finally, we've gotten a number of questions about why we're focused on the unfunded actuarial liability right now when many others want to have a conversation around benefits. I'll talk a little bit about the why in a few slides, but the governor does see a need in 2019 to bring back a conversation that began in 2017, less so about benefits because the governor has concerns about moving forward with any proposals that wouldn't withstand a court test, but definitely around employee contributions and how we might be able to get additional dollars into the system. There was a bill in 2017 around cost and risk sharing that piqued the governor's interest, and we know there are other similar ideas that different groups are pursuing. So why focus on the unfunded actuarial liability? The main rate driver right now, the real driver of increases in employer rates, is the unfunded actuarial liability. I didn't include a slide on this, and I probably should have, but if you take apart the cost for a current Tier 1 or Tier 2 employee, a current OPSERP employee, that's that third tier, and then the unfunded actuarial liability attributed to Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees and OPSERP employees, the largest section is the unfunded actuarial liability that is related to Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees and retirees. That's what's driving these cost increases. And if you see here, there was a $9.5 billion growth in the unfunded actuarial liability in 2014, mainly attributable to three things: the overturning of the reforms from a few years earlier through the Morrow decision at the Supreme Court, having recalculated employer rates and then had those changes overturned, added over $5 billion to the unfunded actuarial liability. There were also two much smaller changes that were important changes that the PERS board made after consultation with the actuaries. Updating mortality assumptions. People are just plain living longer. That means we need more money in the system to pay out their retirements. And then also reducing the rate of return to something that the PERS board felt was more manageable. A lot of what we'll talk about is putting money into side accounts. And we're looking at side accounts as opposed to putting money directly into the funds for a couple of reasons. But the first is that you can choose an amortization period for a side account, a period over which those dollars will be used to offset rates. And generally, depending on the type of account, PERS accounts are amortized over 16 or 20 years at a time. What we're trying to do is get as much money in as quickly as possible. You see those increases in 2019, 21, and 2021, 23. We want to try to offset that increase, especially in 21, 23. Rates then stabilize, and the later increase that you see in 29, 31 isn't actually due to any financial issues within the system. It's due to the expiring or the closing out of side accounts that currently exist, and we'd like money that we put into the system to help smooth that potential future increase as well. Again, that's just money that's offsetting current costs running out, so employers will be looking at the full cost. Pretty soon thereafter, rates start to decrease dramatically, and you'd see that line go down further if this chart extended out more. When we talk about the unfunded actuarial liability, the reason that we're focused on paying this down in a different way, and I should mention there is a plan to pay this off. PERS amortizes that liability over a 20-year period. There's a plan to pay that down, but that plan is leading to the spiking employer rates that we hope to offset. 70% of that liability is attributable to retirees and inactive members. And that's that group that the courts have said we pretty much can't make any benefits changes for. We can't look at them contributing to the system in a different way for the most part. We really just have to pay it, which leads us to looking at how we might be able to pay it differently. The other piece of information that's been helpful for the governor and for my colleagues as we look at the task forces, the UAL task forces report, and think about how we might address the different groups of employers is to break out the liability by employer. We talk about a full liability number, but that's actually attributable to individual employers within the system. And if you look, you'll see the largest chunk of that is within our school districts at 5.25%, 5.5%. The state holds, or rather $5.4 billion. The state holds about $3.25 billion. There's about $2 billion in liability each, collectively held among all of the cities and all of the counties and so on. We also like to look at the unfunded actuarial liability as a percent of payroll. These are average numbers, so that average varies greatly across individual employers, but by employer type, you see the range is generally between about 125% and 175% of payroll. That's not the current cost for those employers. That is, if you look at the total payroll in a year and you look at the total liability held by that employer, how do those compare? And you see that schools have the highest number there at 176%. Given all of that information, as we looked at what principles we should use to view the proposals brought forward by the task force, we focused in on a few things. First, how do we help all employers meet their individual PERS obligations in the best way possible? That large number that we hear about, we use the number $15 billion. That includes side accounts. Some people use a larger number because they're not taking into account the money already in the system through side accounts. Is actually held by each individual employer. And for each employer, there's going to be a different way to pay down their liability. Some employers have planned for those increases. They just want to move forward with the 20-year amortization period to pay down their rates. Some employers have funds in reserves that they'd like to be able to move into side accounts to pay this down more quickly. Other employers are looking at ways they can make cuts to be able to address their increasing costs. And we needed to make sure that anything we brought forward allowed each employer to address their own rates in the way that they saw best. Each of these employers has their own constituencies, their own boards that they're accountable to. The second thing was looking at how we gauge the impact of increases. And we've used two numbers to look at that. The first is that number I put up on the last slide, the total UAL as a percent of payroll. Related to that, we've also looked at the percent of budget directed to payroll. So, for example, about 20% of the state's budget goes directly to payroll. An increase in PERS costs for the state is much less dramatic and much easier to manage toward than an increase in PERS costs to, say, our education partners, where about 90% of the budget goes to payroll. You just have less flexibility and less room to maneuver when so much of your budget is directed to payroll. Those two criteria taken together are what led the governor to focus much of her 2018 bill on how we could direct funds toward K-12 districts to help with their employer costs. And the third principle was the time frame. We're looking at a three biennium time frame. Again, going back to that chart I showed, trying to get money in as soon as possible within three biennia so that it's there as the large increases come through, and then amortizing that out over a period of time to help get us through the expiration of other side accounts. So the legislative bill that I'll go through has two parts. The first is around education, and particularly K-12. The second is around assisting all employers. Within the education focus, we're looking at four things: directing unclaimed property to a side account, looking at debt collection, lawsuit settlements, and other one-time funds that we could direct to a side account for our K-12 schools, and then also looking at windfall revenues or revenues above average that could be directed to that account. Finally, we'll talk about lottery. We're looking at that in a little bit different way. On the side around assisting all employers, we have two things we're looking at: the creation of an employer incentive fund, which was a core piece of the task force report that you have before you, and then also looking at a few ways that we might be able to directly deposit funds into the benefits in force reserve, which is the fund within PERS that actually pays out retirement benefits. That's the best place to put dollars if we're trying to lower the unfunded liability. So I'm going to run through each of those concepts, and Chair Holvey, stop me if I need to pause and explain something in more detail. Otherwise, I'm happy to take questions. There is an account held within the Department of State Lands that captures unclaimed property that comes to the state. So there are a number of ways in which property can default to the state. It's held in trust so that if the title holder of that property comes forward at any time, we can give them back their property. Historically, however, on average, 48-49% of that unclaimed property is ever claimed. The other half of it is not claimed. The peak years, we've seen 57% and 58% claim rates. We've never seen a claim rate higher than that. What you see here, that blue line at the bottom, is the amount of property reported from a given year that has been claimed. The green line across the middle there is the 50% mark, And you'll see up until about 2005, we just about hit that 50% mark, most years staying a little below. The reason the blue bar graph is so much lower in our seeding years is that we just haven't seen all of the claims come in yet. We know more will be claimed. But we've added to that, and the blue line at the top is the total reported unclaimed property from a given year. We've added to that a bar that shows a 35% increase in claimed property. And that 35% number is the amount that we are proposing we redirect from the current trust to an account for our K-12 districts. Right now, unclaimed property, as it sits in trust, earns interest that goes into the Common School Fund to help fund our education system. The math is not really secure yet, so I'm hesitant to use numbers, but it's somewhere around $7 billion a year in the last couple of years that has been, $7 million, I apologize, and that has been split among our education system, among our K-12 districts from that fund. If we were to take, and you see at the top there, 35% of total reported, depending on the time frame, is somewhere between $140 million and $260 million. If we were to take $200 million and put it aside for our education institutions within the PERS system, we think that they would see about triple that benefit annually if we amortized over a 15 or 20-year period in rate offsets within their PERS rates. So the question that we've asked our K-12 districts is whether it's worth it to them to pull those dollars out of the interest-bearing account that they currently sit to earn interest in perpetuity, to actually use some of the principal over the long term to help with their PERS costs. So far, the answer we've gotten is yes. We're working with them, though, to make sure that the math really adds up. That's the first piece we're looking at. And like I said, we're looking at somewhere around $200 million into a side account from that source. Second is one-time revenue streams. Through an executive order issued by the governor, we have worked with our agencies to look at increasing debt collection and established a goal of increasing debt collection 10% above the 2017 collection number by July 1st, 2019. We expect that to bring in about $50 million, and we're proposing that those funds be dedicated to that same site account within PERS that will offset PERS employer costs for K-12 districts. The second one-time revenue stream we're looking at is lawsuit settlements not already dedicated to other sources. This wouldn't touch things like the Volkswagen settlement that's already been dedicated, but any new lawsuit settlements. That's a big unknown because we don't know what those settlements could be, but we'd like to, before those come forward and people run to the front of the line with other ideas for where to use the money, say from the start, we've got a problem over here, we need to put those dollars there should they come available. The third thing in this category is tax amnesty. About 10 years ago, the legislature passed a tax amnesty bill. We don't know what another tax amnesty bill would bring in revenue. We can just look back to see what that bill brought in. And in that case, about $40 million was brought in. About $20 million of that were dollars that the Department of Revenue was already pursuing, but about $20 million, the other half, were new dollars that the Department of Revenue had not yet identified that we were able to bring in through a tax amnesty bill. So we have a tax amnesty portion in the governor's bill as well. The third section around dedicating funds toward a side account for education are revenue upsides, or the excess revenues that sometimes come in from volatile revenue sources. We've looked at capital gains and estate tax increases over a multi-year average, beer, wine, and marijuana tax increases over a multi-year average. We know that marijuana revenues are a little dicey right now, but we do expect that program to continue moving forward in Oregon over the long term while we work out the kinks with the federal government, so we want to include that. On all of those funding types, we're looking at a multi-year average. Generally, those averages have escalators built in, although it varies to what degree from funding stream to funding stream. We also are specifically suspending those revenue sources if the kicker kicks. We don't want to look at using upsides for PERS and then leave a budget hole because we also needed those upsides to pay back with the kicker. We don't know what the potential revenue impact will be here, especially in light of federal tax reform. It's just very hard to predict what's going to happen with these revenue streams. But we asked our financial folks at the state to look, to do a regression looking at over the last 10 years what would have happened had this policy been in place. And in the capital gains category alone, so not looking at those other pieces, but just in capital gains, we would have realized a deposit into the site account in one of those five biennia. But in that one biennium, it would have been to the tune of $192 million, so almost $200 million more dollars. Again, we can't predict what will happen given federal tax reform, but that gives you an idea of the scale that we're talking about with this portion of the bill. Finally, we're looking at increases in lottery revenue. We know that the Lottery Commission is going to be looking at a number of new platforms and gaming types over the next few years, and we are including in the bill language to dedicate increased funds over the most recent projections, and lottery projections actually do include a variety of escalators, looking at projections in number of users, etc. So those projections increase year over year already. Any increases over those most recent projections, which I believe came out in December, would likely be attributable to new gaming types and platforms. And we would dedicate those increases after constitutional obligations. So we're still moving aside those percentages that are constitutionally obligated. This portion of the bill would be dedicated not just to K-12 like the other portions are, but also to universities and community colleges. So it's a little bit different from those first couple of revenue streams. I want to highlight the last point here. The governor's bill will not address lottery policy questions. I know there are a number of lottery policy questions that will need to be undertaken for some of those expansions, and the governor's proposal is that if those expansions are undertaken, the additional dollars for the first three biennia, I think I mentioned everything in this bill is over a 5 or 6 year time period, should be dedicated towards site accounts for our education community. We're not undertaking whether those decisions should be made or not. The second portion of the bill is around how we can assist all employers in paying down their own liabilities. So first portion, how do we get dollars directly into site accounts to offset employer accounts for education? Second portion, how do we help all other employers pay down their own liabilities? One of the primary pieces of the task force report was the creation of an employer incentive fund. The idea here is that many employers have funds that they've been saving outside of PERS. Many employers have their own one-time revenue streams that come up from time to time. And the state should work with those local employers to try to bring those one-time revenue streams, bring those reserve dollars into the PERS system so that they can be counted against the PERS liability and held to offset those employers' individual rate increases in the future. The proposal from the task force was that we match those funds at 25 cents on the dollar, that we only make those matching funds available for asset capital, not for pension obligation bonds or other debt capital. The governor took the step of saying we should make those funds available to employers with the largest debt first, those folks who have a ratio of their payroll to their unfunded liability of 200% or more should get the first bite at the apple of matching funds, but that we should also cap each individual employer's available matching funds to ensure that there are enough funds available for any interested employer. We are asking in the bill for employers to make a dollar commitment within a pretty short period of time, but then giving them a longer period of time to actually come through with those dollars, knowing that we'll have employers who will say, okay, we know we have these revenue streams upcoming. We don't have that money in the door yet, but we'd like to secure our matching funds. Here's how much we believe we'll be able to put into a site account to match. The employer incentive fund is created in the bill, but it is not currently capitalized. As we looked at a number of potential ways to capitalize this fund, it became very clear that there were some pretty important policy conversations that the governor needed to have with you all in the legislature to determine the best way to capitalize that fund. It was also very clear, though, that we couldn't delay in the creation of the fund because we need to give employers enough time to identify those funding streams early so that they can start to put money aside or use their identify their reserves for this purpose. So we have the creation of the fund. In the current draft of the bill, the fund is not capitalized. The proposal within the task force report would have capitalized that fund at about $400 million. That's the dollar amount that we've been shooting for as we have conversations. Finally, we're looking at ways that we could deposit dollars directly into the benefits in force reserve to have an impact for all employers. Because the spread is across so many employers, when we make those deposits, the individual impact for each employer is relatively small, but we do need to start looking at every way we can to get dollars into that fund to help each employer. The main piece in the legislation that we're bringing forward is that we're asking the Treasurer's Office to study whether to reinvest some of the accounts that they hold in more aggressive ways that would still provide security to our governments whose dollars they are holding, but that would be able to realize some upside which would be able to be deposited into the benefits in force reserve. We're not making any move in that direction yet. We're just asking the Treasurer's Office to study the issue, look at what options they might have to do that, what the security trade-offs are, and what the potential benefits are. With that, I am happy to answer any questions about the governor's bill, and I would direct questions about the work of the task force to either Corey or myself.
Thank you very much. It was very well done, comprehensive. Questions, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I might, here. Last time I looked, many public employer pensions were upside down here in the United States. Not a pretty sight with most states. I guess my question would be to Corey, is a clearinghouse available, an information clearinghouse, where you can see what other states are doing with their UAL?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, we did look at two or three other states that have taken a similar approach as to what can they do to actually come up with cash to pay down their liability. And some of those are incorporated in our report, and some we didn't feel were appropriate. The sale leaseback of buildings actually is an example that another state was doing and didn't feel it would pencil out. But we did, only two or three states seem to have taken this approach. However, we did look at those.
Right. And just to follow up, if I might, and forgive me if I missed this, but is the corpus of the Common School Fund fungible for purposes of UAL?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wilson, there are two portions to the Common School Fund, and there is a constitutionally dedicated corpus which is not fungible. The unclaimed property is actually outside of the constitutionally dedicated corpus. It is a legislatively dedicated piece of the fund, so that is fungible through legislative action.
Okay, thank you.
And to follow up on his question and looking at other states, do we have any information or municipalities or local governments have some of their own plans about how to raise money to pay down their UAL?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, through the conversations that task force members had with various local governments, we have some anecdotal information. We know that there are some local governments who are well prepared and others who have not prepared at all. Part of what the task force found was that many local governments didn't feel like they had the handle on their future payments that we thought they would. In the past, every PERS employer has been given their current portion of the liability and their current rates, and a look at how rates system-wide will change into the future. And our assumption had been that employers were using that information to extrapolate what their rates would be in the future and what various savings and side accounts would do to those rates. It turns out some employers were doing that, but not all, and that's why the governor asked the PERS agency to create that employer tool I talked about early on to help them better identify what their futures look like.
Representative Doherty was next, and then Representative Bynum.
The question I had was the slide that you had on unfunded liability by employer types. And the question I have is why is there such a disparity, for example, between community colleges and school districts? And I've kind of, because I'm very familiar with PERS and it worked with it for a lot and this kind of thing, but I never could understand why it was, because there were times when the PERS liability was actually higher for school districts, yet the payroll was lower than some of the other municipalities. So do you have an answer?
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, I know that our PERS agency director, Steve Rodeman, is in the back of the room, and he's probably going to glare at you all, and I won't see it if I answer this wrong. So please let me know if that happens.
Okay.
There are a number of factors that go into calculating employer rates. Part of what you see in the raw numbers there just has to do with total payroll. There is a higher payroll within education than there is within community colleges. As you look at liability compared to payroll, though, that percentage number there, there are variations in experiences with pension obligation bonds. Some employers took those out at a good time, and they have a far lower liability than other employers do. Some employers took those out at a less good time, and it did not work out so well for them. There are variations as different employers entered employer pools over the resources that they were able to bring to that pool. So there are a lot of things that go into those numbers.
I forgot about the pension obligation bonds, because there were quite a few school districts that did that. So thank you.
And I don't see him glaring, so.
Wonderful. I'll take that as a win.
So other questions? Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I have a question. Is there a financial rating system that, for instance, these employers get that tells them that they're in over their head on their pension liability? Because to me, if I were to go to a bank, there are six or seven different measures that I have to meet that tell the bank that I'm bankable. But we have 176% of payroll being allocated for school districts. Like something, like once you get to 100 or once you get to 80%, something should say you shouldn't spend anymore. You shouldn't negotiate that contract with money you don't have.
Representative Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, there is not something like that directly from PERS. The agency's job is to make sure that the system maintains its funded status and has benefits available to pay out to retirees. We have, through this tool that has been created, tried to help employers better understand their standing. I will tell you that when we look across employers, the average is, I would say, around 150% of liability or payroll in liability. So it is well over 100. Where we start to get really worried is those employers who have over 200%. Those are the ones that we look at and we say, we don't know how these folks are going to be able to meet these obligations. One of the reasons that our K-12 districts stood out to us is that as you look, and there are a number of slides I didn't include in the name of time, but we do have broken down the number of employers by type with a negative liability, because some do have a negative liability, with 0 to 50%, 50 to 100, 100 and 150, 150 to 200 and 250 and more. And the bulk of employers in almost every employer type are between 100 and 200% payroll. Within education, there's a very large group of employers who are above 100, or rather are above 250%.
So in the spirit of transparency, can we list all of the employers and where they are? Because I feel like if taxpayers knew that their district is in an unhealthy part, then maybe there's more political will to change some things about how we do revenue, how we do our school budgets, how we do our county budgets. But I think, and then that also balances with what we're asking our teachers to do, and where the money's going to come from. But I feel like we're working in the dark with who's healthy and who's not.
Chair Holvey, Representative Bynum, I'm not actually sure how public that information is, but I can find out and get back to you. I will tell you that the comment you just made echoes many of the conversations had by the task force, and trying to bring that information to light, trying to then encourage local governments to put more money toward their liability through the creation of that incentive fund, and and trying to make sure that those individual employers and their constituents had a better idea of what the liability that, you know, again, going back to my earlier slides, is a liability that we have to pay. This is not a conversation around benefits for good reason. Why that liability is there and what it looks like into the future was a large piece of the conversation had by the task force.
Other questions?
Just one, and this is probably, I won't say a dumb question, but maybe an easy answer. I know that some, you know, you're using that 200% percentage of, you know, unfunded liability to payroll. I know many other pension programs use a different measurement of the percentage of assets to liabilities, the actual,
status.
Which I think Representative Bynum is sort of referencing. So that just is not an apples-to-apples comparison for this sort of a government pension program, because I'm just wondering why the difference, you know, because I think some are considered, if they're 85% funded, they're in pretty good shape, you know.
Chair Holby, that is a number that PERS uses as they discuss the health of the fund and the extent of the liability. One of the things that we have tried to do is say, okay, everybody looks at that funded status number, and everybody looks at the number that is the liability. What are some different ways we can look at this to try to take that apart and get a better sense, employer by employer or employer type by employer type, of how we address the unfunded liability? What the governor has really come to is that we need to help all employers address their own liabilities, because it is a liability held by each individual employer, but that we also probably, given those other ways of looking at it, need to pay some extra attention to our school districts. So we have not given up on that one way of looking at it. We just are adding in some others.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you very much for your
presentation.
Thank you for the work on the task force. I look forward to some more conversations about some of these options and discussing the bill when it comes before us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, up next, we have a discussion of another proposed legislation for 2018 from the governor, and with that, I'd like to call up Lindsay Baker, Ilana, if you're ready to come back up. You're on my list too, as she just left, and Margaret Salazar. Ilana, if you need a break, you know, just, you know, we're happy to wait for you.
I apologize, Chair Holby.
No, it's not at all.
Good afternoon, Chair Holby and members of the committee. For the record, Lindsay Baker with the Department of Administrative Services. So we are here today to talk about another of the five measures that the governor is bringing for the 2018 legislative session. And most of you have already heard about this measure, so what I would like to do is sort of walk through the measure itself at a very high level and then turn it over to my colleagues to talk a little bit more about their perspective and where they're coming from with it. So as you all may or may not recall, the idea here is to really grow and make stronger our existing construction industry, our trades industry, and also really invest in the lack of affordable housing across the state, or perhaps reverse that and increase some of our affordable housing across the state. So the measure itself has three parts. The first part deals with licensing provisions. So our proposal is for folks who have been working in the industry, in the construction industry, for 8 or more years, and I'm talking about 4 licenses here, so general residential licenses, contractor licenses, specialty contractor licenses that are given by the CCB, and supervising electrician and plumbing licenses that are given by the Building Codes Division. So for those 4 licenses, if you've worked in the industry for 8 or more years, then we will waive all of the fees that you would pay to the state. So license fees, application fees, exam fees. We will also waive the formal education requirements that are required to actually sit for the examination itself. These folks will still have to take the exam to demonstrate that they understand the laws and the regulations about doing that business and doing and performing that work. But the 16 to 25 hours of formal in the classroom, we're going to waive that piece. So that's the first part. The second part, we have heard from folks that are, and what we're really targeting sort of is the wage earner and trying to turn this wage earner that's right now working for a firm and have them start their own small business, bring on some employees, and really to grow this industry. What we've heard is just sort of this lack of access to capital. And so we're proposing to give access to a fund that's already created and it's already been capitalized that right now sits inside of Business Oregon. It's called the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, or EDLF. And the idea would be if you are a new small business, so have availed yourself of the first piece of this program, and you agree to perform 25% of your work on qualifying projects in rural areas, then you would now be eligible to take a loan out from this fund. And when we talk about qualifying projects, we're talking about affordable housing, sort of that lower end of market rate housing, sometimes called workforce housing and small commercial. That's the second piece. And then the third piece of this program is access to a different set of funds that right now sits inside of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. The funds themselves flow out through the Workforce Investment Board, so they're a little bit more regional in nature. But the idea here is that if you're a new small business, again, having availed yourself of the program in the first piece, then you agree to bring on an apprentice, a recent CTE graduate as a new employee, then you can have access to grant funding to help these individuals really get to work. So buy tools, safety equipment, these types of things to get in the door and start working. So that's what the measure does. Be happy to answer any questions or turn it over to hear from Ilana or Margaret about what they have to say.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Ilana Pertl-Ginny, the governor's labor and workforce policy advisor, now taking off my labor hat and putting on my workforce hat. Thank you for having us today to talk about this bill. I will be brief because Lindsay's given a good overview of the policy, but as we have talked to stakeholders within the construction industry, it is clear that there are some barriers to meeting our housing needs in a number of parts of the state. And as we look at an aging construction workforce, and as we look at a growing number of projects as the economy continues to boom in the metro areas of the state, we know that we need to do more to ensure that we have a sustainable workforce in other parts of the state. We also want to make sure that we keep our promise to students coming out of CTE programs that there will be jobs available in their communities, in the types of industries that they've gained interest in through their education. We are hoping to meet those as well as a number of housing goals through the passage of this bill. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that get a little more technical in nature.
Great. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today regarding this jobs and workforce strategy that has the potential to address the rapidly rising costs of housing construction across the state. You've heard an overview of the features of the bill and the potential impact on the workforce, and I'm here today to give you a little bit of specific information about the housing needs of the state and how this bill can help meet those goals as well. OHCS, as you know, is Oregon's housing finance agency. We provide financing to build and preserve affordable housing for seniors and working families across the state. We also foster homeownership opportunities and provide housing stability for thousands of our neighbors every year. This bill will help facilitate the development of affordable housing, which of course is my agency's purview, but it will also help to spur market rate housing development that is so acutely needed to address the lack of housing supply across the state. Over the course of the last year, we have seen housing construction costs skyrocket. A survey completed in June 2017 from one of the major affordable housing general contractors that we work with estimated that construction costs were rising anywhere from 6% to 18% within just a few months on each project in their pipeline. A key driver of cost increases is the increase in the cost of labor, exacerbated by the lack of firms in the marketplace available to bid on residential jobs. This cost escalation poses major challenges for our state as we grapple with a historic housing crisis. First, it adds to the cost of affordable housing developments financed by our agency, which leverage local and private investment to make and stretch state dollars as far as they can possibly go to get housing in the ground in our communities. This added cost creates unanticipated funding gaps, which means that needed housing is delayed or stalled, or that ultimately fewer homes end up being built in our communities. And second, the rising cost of construction is just one more barrier to getting additional housing supply, even on the market rate side, into rural communities. Rural areas are already struggling to attract housing development and market rate developers, and this cost escalation makes it harder to make housing development pencil out in those underserved parts of our state. I wanted to share a few thoughts and examples of what we're seeing on the ground, so you have some concrete examples of the kinds of impact that we're hoping to make with this bill. The problem is occurring in large cities and small towns across the state. We are hearing that the multifamily housing market is served by a base of smaller subcontractors that are less capitalized than in other sectors of the construction industry and are less prepared to bid on housing developments. In one example, we know of an Astoria area project where the housing sponsor has not been able to receive the necessary three qualified bids from subcontractors. The project is being built with public funding, including state dollars, that require three bids. So the project is stalled and the community's housing needs are hanging in the balance while they're waiting to receive three bids from the qualified subcontractors. In Central Oregon, one of our recent developments was stalled for several weeks because the project sponsor literally received zero bids from roofers. The delay added significant costs and uncertainty to the project. And sometimes the subcontractors are stretched so thin that they are not able to meet project timelines, with sometimes devastating results. In one example in the Portland metro area, a subcontractor on a housing job got delayed for 3 weeks because they were pulled in two directions finishing up another existing job. They were not able to bring in new staff and to recruit additional staff on a short timeline. A sponsor had a half-built skeleton of a building to finish, and that was in November and December, which you can imagine what that meant in terms of weather. A dry building sat exposed for 3 weeks during the delay, and the building ended up being drenched in a rainstorm, which caused the developer to blow through its construction contingency trying to dry out the building, and now they are weeks behind with major cost implications. So those are just a few concrete examples of what we're seeing across the state. We're eager to work with the committee to move forward on these solutions that can help alleviate the housing costs and to help us deliver more housing for Oregon communities. Thank you again for the opportunity to address you this afternoon.
Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what did you say? I'm sorry, I missed it, but what were the other licenses that were available? You mentioned four, I think.
Sure. Chair Hold, Representative Barreto. So the four licenses and endorsements that we've been talking about so far have been the general residential contractor, CCB, the specialty contractor, also CCB, supervising electrician, and plumbing from Building Codes Division. So just those four.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. I spent some time recently talking to general contractors in my district, Grants Pass, Josephine County. Many of them, who I grew up knowing well, were knocked out of the business during the Great Recession, and that certainly has not recovered, that number of folks. Subs getting really, really hard to find, so I would certainly agree with what you've said there. And I'm just, no big comment here, but teaming that with fees and land use regulations and things like that, we got a real problem. And so, yeah, the problem you enunciate today, I think, is certainly a real one. It is in my district. But also land supply and land costs, really difficult as well. If we could whip all this together, I think we'd see some real improvement here, which I think it's undeniably needed. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. So, thank you.
Other questions? So I just have a question. I know the focus of part of the focus of this proposal is to increase the capacity of contractors. When you're talking about the increased costs, Are these increased costs because of the lack of contractors? So the price is going up because there's so much demand that, or is it that we have a shortage of workforce and so that price is going up, or is it both?
Representative, thank you very much for the question, and I think maybe Ilana and I can both attempt to answer this one. I can speak generally around the housing development costs. I mean, that's something that we push on every single day from a multitude of different directions, everything from land use issues, land costs, labor costs, materials costs, and development soft costs. So we're looking at all array of those issues. With regard to the actual construction industry piece, what we're hearing from our development partners is that there's a lack of competition because we don't have those small firms in the marketplace putting in bids. So you just simply don't have that competition. Now, what that means in terms of the workforce and the labor costs, perhaps I'll let Ilana take that one.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for the question. As Director Salazar said, we are focused here on how we can increase the number of firms. I know that there are a number of discussions around whether there are enough workers in the pipeline in the construction industry as well. And, you know, that's a delicate balance because we want to make sure that there are enough people to perform the work. We want to make sure that we are not driving up costs on that side. On the other hand, we know that we're in a market expansion right now and wages in a lot of industries are going up, and we don't want to artificially cap those increases if they're appropriate at this point in the market. We're having conversations in other arenas about what we can do to help people move into the workforce. The governor is very interested in a lot of those conversations and has been having a number of conversations with those in the industry around apprenticeship programs. But I think that's a different conversation than the one that we're having here, which is more focused on firms and on turning, as we said earlier in the presentation, turning those wage earners into business owners.
Thank you. That helps. Sam Doherty.
This may be a little off the subject, but it deals with workforce housing. And I work with a group that has, like, a lot of minimum wage workers that work with developmentally disabled adults and in large areas and so on. And they were talking, nonprofit was talking about some sort of incentives that they would get where they would actually have workforce housing for their workers, because their workers, where the large part of where their workers work, cannot afford the housing there. And they're having a hard time getting to work because sometimes they have to travel 15 miles to get there. And so is there any talk, and this might be off the subject, of having some sort of incentives for workforce housing? I know they do it for teachers in the Bay Area and L.A., and even some places in Oregon they're bringing in manufactured homes because they can't afford the housing. So is there talk of that?
Certainly. Chair Holvey and Representative Doherty, thank you for that question. As our agency is working very closely with the regional solutions teams and the governor's office, we actually have an initiative on the street right now, which is a workforce housing pilot program that we've developed through regional solutions with the other regional solutions cabinet agencies to really get at this issue around employers that are wanting to come to the table to work with the state and also work with developers to create strategies to house their workforce at various income levels. And this sort of gets to the point I was making earlier, which is that we have a need to develop more affordable housing, and that is squarely in our agency's purview. But we recognize that even market solutions right now, there's something missing here that we need to push on to understand why that housing is not being delivered in our communities. So we have a pilot program out now to invite local communities to submit proposals for what those creative models might look like so that we can learn from those projects and potentially find out what's working and expand that into other communities.
Great. Thank you very much.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I really look forward to this particular proposal. It's, I think on target for really trying to get out, maybe not out in front of a problem, but trying to address a problem for certain. So thank you very much, and have a good weekend.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. colleagues, up next in our informational meeting, I wanted to have a short discussion and really just a presentation of our legislative committee legislative concepts that we've been working on and we'll be bringing forward. And I want to bring up some people to talk about these concepts, largely to describe the issue. Some of these concepts have obviously proposed LCs on them that are still a work in progress, as many of these conversations are continuing currently and will probably continue to the start of the session. And so with that, our first legislative concept, I'm going to turn over to Jan to describe for us, and then we'll call up a couple of folks to further describe the issue and kind of the status of where we're at right now. So,
Mr. Chair and committee members, LC 209, will seem familiar to you. It was based on House Bill 2907. The committee had a hearing on this issue. It is about building inspectors, and the concept that was before you during session was limited to building inspectors. This is also including building officials. So the concept in just most general terms would allow a specialized building inspector to be employed by a private entity. Right now, the statute requires that they be employed by the Building Codes Division or by a municipality. And the concept goes, adds to what you saw during session, to require the designated building official to also be an employee of a local government. So building official employed by local government, but allows building inspector to be employed by a private entity.
Thank you. And so I think we have Alana mm-hmm. Cox and
Aaron Doyle
and Rocky Dallum.
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to start?
I'll give it a go.
Yeah, I think, you know, Rocky, maybe you should start because you brought 2907 forward.
You brought it.
As a proponent, which started this discussion last session and now has been in a work group for a while, and we're still noodling on a solution. But if largely I'd like to describe the issue.
Okay.
You know, with that, and then the issue sort of expands a little bit from your conversation, probably.
I think that's right, Chair Holvey. Committee, Rocky Dallum, I'm representing Claire Company and Northwest Code Professionals, two family-owned businesses that have been providing technical advice and expertise and services to municipalities for several decades since we went to a uniform statewide code. And I think that's right. Our bill last session sort of kicked the hornet's nest, if that's the way to frame it up. And so I think we're apt to kind of give that background and talk about where we stand today. So, like I said, our companies provide a range of services to municipalities around code enforcement, and brought a bill last session to address a relatively narrow problem. And that was that a certain type of inspector that, to say it crudely, inspects light commercial or light industrial projects. And these are specialized plumbing inspectors and specialized electrical inspectors. As the law stands now, you can only be a specialized plumbing or a specialized electrical inspector if you're an employee of a municipality or the state government. That really created several problems, but here's sort of the example. You've got an individual who sits for the exam with BCD and is qualified to carry out that certain type of inspection. If cities, who are our folks' clients, are either small cities or counties, don't have the capacity for a full in-house person, they don't have the ability to contract out for those two types of inspectors. So they've got to wait for someone either from the state or the county, and that slows down these inspections. The other example for the bigger jurisdictions is just backfill. When you're in the boom times like we are now, you have bigger jurisdictions who have in-house specialized inspectors, but they can't contract out to fill those gaps. And then the third example, which I kind of, you know, use as it's probably the most absurd, is you could have a specialized inspector, say they work in the city of Salem today, announce their retirement, eat cake, have a party, and then on Wednesday the city calls and says, hey, we got a project, can you come do this? They can't, simply because they're not employed, can't contract for that same person regardless of experience and qualification. So again, as Ms. Norland said, that was the bill that we had last session that we talked about, which created the work group. First and foremost, that issue is addressed here in LC 209. We had some conversations with BCD about language. The language looks different, but it's captured and addressed, and we're really grateful for all of the time and effort to address that. And I think in the letter from BCD that's on OLIS, they acknowledge that throughout the work group, we really don't have any major legal or policy issues with our narrow issue. So that's where we stand. On the broader issues or the other issues around city programs and delegation, I think I'd probably leave it to the folks to my left and my right to get into to those issues. And we want to give credit to you, Representative Holvey, for drafting language and getting us to where we are, because we know how difficult it's been to either hear the specific problem that we're trying to address and get a problem statement and a clear solution to it, and also figure out if we've got a constitutional issue or not, or if we've got a statutory issue. And I know that we're waiting for some guidance from DOJ potentially. So we appreciate you taking up the pen on something that's kind of been kicking around here for a few months. The only thing I'll leave off with you with from our clients is we're committed to the technical aspects of code enforcement and safe, efficient permitting processes for everyone, owners, construction, and our clients who are the municipalities. We just want to ensure that any draft doesn't risk our folks' business and livelihood and the service that they provide to the cities. But we're committed to looking at this LC, and we have, you know, some concerns initially, but are going to go through it deeply to see what's workable, ask questions about what we don't understand, and can provide all the technical assistance that either the cities, BCD, or the contractors in the industry don't have of how our business model works and what they do. And I know that they're willing to do that. Some of our folks, as you know, provide this sort of advice on a national level and have a great experience. So we're happy to continue providing that and hope we can get to a product that works for everyone.
Thank you. I think it makes sense for Alana perhaps to go next.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Alana Cox. I'm from the Building Codes Division, making sure you have Alana in front of you for every panel today.
Differently here.
Yes, spelled differently.
You can move the microphone just a little closer to you. Just a little bit. That's good.
Mark's not able to be here. Mark Long, our administrator, but he did submit a letter that's up on OLIS, and I just kind of want to run through the highlights of that testimony. Thank you for putting together the work group, and I think we had some good conversations, and thank you for sharing this LC. As has been mentioned, it would allow that light commercial inspector certification for private third parties. It would require building officials to be employed by municipalities. I think building codes doesn't have any legal or policy concerns with either of those concepts, as long as they're drafted in such a way that doesn't kind of adversely impact some of our ongoing legal concerns. Through the work group we shared, we've asked our counsel at the Department of Justice to look at a few questions regarding this third-party inspection model, whether it could constitute an illegal delegation of a government function to a third party, whether there's some kind of labor law questions around whether they're properly considered independent contractors, and then what, if any, liability the state may bear when we delegate a program to a municipality who then delegates it to a private company. So we don't have an answer yet on those questions. I don't know when we're going to get that answer. So in the meantime, we're interested in working on this LC and kind of building on this concept. And we would recommend taking a look at the different kinds of roles that building officials hold in Oregon. There are essentially two models. One is more of a technical expert model, where someone has a background in the building trades and possesses certifications to perform inspections or plan reviews on their own as the building official. The other model is more of an administrator model, where they manage the building program, but they themselves don't have that technical background in the building codes. In either case, the building official is ultimately responsible for the program, for overseeing the inspection work, for resolving disputes. And it provides some flexibility to municipalities to set up the program in the way that makes the most sense to them. But where that technical expert is the building official, they're in a good position to oversee contracted work because they have that expertise where they're accountable for that program. Where it's an administrator model, where they don't have that technical background, we recommend thinking about whether they should have to directly employ some technical experts at the municipal level to be able to have some oversight and control over that and also be able to rely on that technical expertise. But in either case, I think we want to continue the ability to use third-party contractors as backup services to maintain those service levels for communities. So we're happy to participate going forward as you continue to tackle this issue, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And last, let's hear from Aaron Doyle.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. First, I want to talk to the first part of the bill that Rocky spoke to. This is something we supported in the last session, and we continue to support how it's being handled in LC 209. These specialized inspectors serve both roles as our backfill when we have internal programs with internal inspectors, more inspections than we have staff to accomplish, but also for those smaller jurisdictions that contract out for those specific inspecting services. We need these specialized inspectors. The whole purpose for most of our municipal governments when they decide to take on a local program and take over usually from a county in this instance is that we're looking to provide a better customer service opportunity and to make sure that the program is run more efficiently, effectively, and responsive in a more timely manner to those that are doing the buildings in our smaller cities in usually regionally pretty large counties. Just the most of the 25, we think, impacted cities related to the third-party hiring, most of them that I've been able to speak to have stated they did this because the county just wasn't providing the levels of service necessary to maintain a robust building industry to handle both the economic development and the housing needs for the community. And that there are pieces that are always have remained internal to the city. There are pieces that are done by the third party, and they're very wary of making the fees too high, but they want the program to be run effectively. We at the League have taken a look at some of the broad issues that we've heard expressed. We don't feel that we have a clear understanding of what exactly the delegation issue relates to. At this point in time, our legal analysis, to the extent I am allowed to talk about it, is that we don't believe that we're running into delegation issues within these programs, and other issues, we haven't delved deeply into it, and so I'm not at liberty to make any sort of legal declarations. I probably shouldn't do that anyway. So we're interested in moving forward. We are starting to look at LC 209, but our biggest concern at this point in time is that we're not, if we don't know what the specific issue is or where that line is, we don't want to enact statute that might have other ramifications that we haven't thought of or that might not actually solve the problem, because the question of delegation is a constitutional one, and as much as we'd like to, statute can't trump constitution. And so we want to make sure that anything that comes out of this work group process actually solves the problem. We're also trying to look at what the ramifications of having to have an in-house building official. There's some education that I need to do for my membership as to what a building official can and cannot do. And with the suggestion that I just read in BCD's written testimony, I have further concerns that if we're continuing to split between third-party programs and internal programs and how they're overseen, we're splitting hairs that might not necessarily need splitting, but we haven't done a deep enough dive. I think the stakeholder group started to talk about that. I'm excited about having that continuing conversation and moving forward. Our primary concern at this point is if we don't solve this problem in this session, which we're not sure that we can do until we know what DOJ's real problems are, if we don't solve it in this session, we may see a large percentage of those 25 city programs shut down by BCD action, which will lead us down a path of litigating the issues, and that's more expensive for everyone. and we'd like to prevent that from happening, and I'm open to creative thought processes on that, which I had a moment of that outside in the hallway, which I haven't spoken to anyone about, but perhaps a moratorium on shutting down our programs for these particular reasons, but not for those reasons, like if we are embezzling all the funds, that's a pretty legitimate reason to close down a program. We're not doing that. We're not, hypothetically. We don't do that. We account for our dollars. We send those accountings to BCD. Anyway, sorry. A little humor in the afternoon.
Make sure you got that on the record.
Yeah. Thank you for protecting me from myself. But we are committed to moving forward. What we want to do is ensure that the local programs are run effectively, efficiently, and in a timely and cost-efficient manner for those that have to work through our inspection programs at the local level.
Thank you. So, committee members, that's a lay of the land on this particular issue, and I've spent a great deal of time thinking about this one, and I must stress the importance that I think Ms. Doyle stressed and others are alluded to. I think a solution in February is really important if we can achieve some sort of compromise and solution that addresses all these issues. So I encourage us to all stay in touch between now and the first week of February, and we'll be trying to facilitate our conversation from our end in trying to answer some of these questions. So, and moving forward, I learn a little bit more about it every day, it seems. So I want to thank you both, all three of you, for giving us a presentation. I don't know if anybody has a specific question about the process. We'll obviously be getting into the details of this during session. So thank you for, I don't see anything, so thank you very much for introducing the issue to us.
Thank you.
Up next, we have LC 211, also the result of some conversations last year in a work group. Thank you very much, Representative Evans, and John Gear and Daryl Fuller. Thank you, Representative Evans. A few opening comments.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. I actually want to start, and I'll finish with Kumbaya. Kumbaya, dear Lord, Kumbaya. Jan, her patience. It's going to be like the Academy Awards thing. Jan, her patience. Daryl, John, DOJ, and Al, who unfortunately got dragged into this unexpectedly, who we will get out of this as soon as possible, all came together around a problem that is probably occurring in all of our districts, but this really came out of an issue with constituents in our district where vehicle repair shops, most vehicle repair shops are operated by good people who try to do great things. A few, shall we say, are not in that category. And there is a particular device that has been and currently is available to all whether or not they meet those different requirements. So we tried to figure out a way that was something that everybody could agree on, something that would actually fix a problem that's there, and make sure that folks who are doing the job the way they should are not penalized in some way. That was really the way that we approached it. So I'm going to stop there and probably forgot something. Jan, what did I forget?
I'm sure they can fill
it. Okay. Yeah. Well, at that point, I'm going to hand it off to the folks who actually made the deal happen.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is John Gear. I thank you for having me back. We spoke about this last year, and the issue is that there are people in Oregon who, on the worst day of their life, other than, you know, an involvement in the criminal justice system, is when their car breaks down and they have a need to get to work or a need to pick up the kids. Their car breaks down.
John, I'm not sure you stated your name for the record.
I'm sorry. John Gear, and from Salem. I'm an attorney in private practice, but I am representing myself here. I'm here because I became aware of this issue with, you know, the 1% of the repair shops who give the other 99% the bad name. There are a lot of great repair shops who do a great job. The problem is that 100% of the repair shops have access to what's called the motor vehicle, the mechanics lien. And, you know, by virtue of your car ending up in a repair shop, whether you drive it in, whether it's towed in, once your car is in the hands of the repair guy, and I say guy, there are some women owned shops, so I shouldn't say just guy, but once your car is in the repair shop, that shop has a lien. They can claim a lien on your car. Even if they haven't done anything, they can say, well, I inspected it, I put time and I put effort into it. And they can demand a payment before you can retrieve your car. And they can, if you don't have the money to give them, or you don't think they did the job, or they're criminals, they can sell your, you know, the upshot is they can end up selling your car out from under you. That protects repair shops really well. Repair shops are very well protected against the scheming consumer who gets their car fixed and wants to go down the road without paying for the job. That doesn't happen. But there is no protection today for the consumer who has an RV or a car or a truck, and the fix isn't made, the right parts aren't used, the salvage parts are used without disclosure, the car doesn't run, the car is taken apart, and then the guy says, you know, the holdup game, I need more money, I can't, you know, you haven't given me enough money. The consumer can't get their car back. We wanted a very light approach, and what we came up with was, in order to exercise the vehicle lien, these shops have to have a bond. In other words, they have to be able to pay a judgment if they rip off a consumer and the consumer brings an action against them and gets a judgment. So that's all it does. It may be the most invisible legislation you ever discuss, because really the good shops don't engage in any of this. And hopefully we get rid of the bad shops by a requirement that they have a bond. And that way, I have two judgments in my office right now that are worthless judgments, because these shady shops with no bonds are, they just disappear. When you sue them, they just say, hey, I got nothing. And the consumer is left with, in one case, a $4,500 problem, and stolen headlights, you know, the high-intensity halogen headlights stolen out of their vehicle and sold on the market by the repair shop. And in another case, a guy, you know, lost his treasured 67 VW Beetle for 6 months, and finally he had to come in with a tow truck and take his Beetle back with the engine in the back seat. The guy hadn't done anything and had kept his money. He's worthless. So now there will be a pot of money, a $20,000 bond, to allow a recovery. And the nice thing is we didn't say everybody has to get the bond. So this doesn't get the guy who just wants to work on his friend's brakes for a few bucks or a case of beer. All this says is, if you want to use the lien, you have to have a bond. So basically, it will create a system where the really low-end shops, they can still exist, and if they're friends and they're working on their friends' cars, nobody's got a problem with that. But if they're too cheap to buy a bond to protect the public, then they shouldn't have access to the mechanics lien. And so that's all it does. And we hope that our intention is to publicize this and encourage people, make sure you know you're using a bonded repair shop. And that Daryl's folks, Daryl can talk about educating the trade members of the importance of it, and making sure that the trade and the industry tells the consumer, hey, I'm a bonded shop. You're protected here. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I've probably taken too long, but I really do appreciate your work on this issue.
Daryl.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association, NATA, among other groups, represents collision and mechanical repair shops in the state of Oregon. On a 3:30 on a Friday afternoon, I can't think of any place I'd rather be than sitting next to Representative Evans and John Gear at the Capitol building here in Salem. My clients, who are the repair industry, have two things that frustrate them a lot. One is that the 1% that we've already talked about make the 99% look bad. And we would like nothing more than to get those people out of business because they make us look bad. On the other hand, the other thing that frustrates those businesses, and a lot of businesses across the state of Oregon, is when the government comes up with a solution that increases costs, increases paperwork, increases time and effort on behalf of the legitimate businesses that the 1% just ignore anyway. And so we're paying additional costs, and we're doing additional paperwork, and we're going through additional processes to protect consumers when we're the guys that aren't causing the problems in the first place. It's the 1% that we'd all like to get rid of. So there's this natural tension between us wanting to get rid of the bad guys, too, and trying to find a way to do that, and at the same time not wanting to pay more costs because that makes the illegitimate guys cheaper by comparison, and it's easier for them to get our customers and for them to cause a lot of problems. So last session, during the long session, Representative Evans, on behalf of John, introduced a bill that we really, really, really didn't like. And so I met with Representative Evans, and with the support of the chair, which we appreciate, I said, rather than working on the bill during session when we're all doing lots of other things, would you please give me permission to put together a work group during the interim of all the stakeholders and see if we couldn't find a solution to the problem that was closer to a scalpel rather than a shotgun, which is what the original bill was. And again, thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us that permission, for Representative Evans, for trusting me in putting together the group. We had Department of Justice, DCBS, DMV, repair guys, consumer lawyers, all in a room, and we sat around and we found something that we think is going to help solve that problem. So I said, I think a great example of the way this process is supposed to work. We appreciate the opportunity to be at the table, and we're looking forward to hopefully passing a bill quickly through the February session, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you all for doing your work and somehow getting the shotgun out of Rep. Evans's hands. Closing comment? Yeah,
thank you, Chair Holvey. Shotguns are right now put away. The one thing I do want to mention is there is an amendment coming that has been agreed upon by all hands. And basically, when you are trying to put this together, and again, it was a great conversation, the net accidentally got something in the net that no one intended, and that has to do with tow trucks. Tow trucks have their own world in terms of insurance and all kinds of things, so the amendment will exclude tow trucks, but that's because we never intended to include the tow trucks. So I just want to make sure that the bill coming forward literally is a kumbaya. Everybody recognizes it, helps the folks that are doing the right thing, it goes after the folks that are doing the bad thing, and it doesn't involve people that aren't supposed to be involved. I just want to say again, I appreciate how much time everybody involved put into this, and I truly appreciate Chair Holvey's willingness to both allow the work group and, number two, allow this to potentially be a committee bill. So thank you.
No questions. Thank you very much for your presentation. And the next committee bill, LC 213, we have Bill Perry and Dan Bates. And Jan, do you want to briefly describe it?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and committee members, the committee had referred to it last session, House Bill 2857. It never received a hearing, but there were meetings between the stakeholders during session and throughout the interim. It's a bill that deals with the performing rights societies that sign contracts with proprietors when music is being performed. And we heard primarily from the Oregon wine growers working on this issue about some problems in how the relationship is conducted. The measure that is before you enhances the code of conduct that already exists in statute for the way that performing rights societies interact with the proprietors. And it enhances the existing private right of action by allowing the court to impose a fine for willful violations. and it requires the Performing Rights Society to give at least 72 hours notice to the proprietor before entering into a contract. And in that notice, they're to provide materials about what music is covered in the contract and what the fees would be. I think that's the gist of it.
Mr. Perry, would you like to go first and try to describe the issue for us?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and I'll refer to them as PROs, which is public or performing rights organizations. I try to do PRS, but I, you know, old habits die hard. So what happens is anybody that's been in a retail establishment, if you have music, whether it's in the background or you go all the way up to hiring bands, you're required by federal law to get a license basically to make sure that all the writers and performers get their royalties over the long run. That's in federal law. There's, you know, whether you like it or not like it, there's nothing we can do at this level to change that. So these retail establishments owe money. Anybody that's ever been in a situation where you have a provider of service and a customer usually have a thing where you can negotiate back and forth. And a lot of time in this particular case, you really can't negotiate back and forth. And so I'm not going to sit there and say that all the people that come to pursue these licenses from the retailers, most of them don't do a bad job, but because they have that leverage, they can come at very inopportune times. You know, in a restaurant, they might come at lunch hour. You know, if they try to go to a music venue where the band's on and you've got all this stuff going on trying to negotiate it there, it's just very difficult from a management standpoint. And there have been, you know, it's funny. I've been at the Restaurant Association for over 20 years. I get a call almost twice a month for the last 20 years of people having situations with these PROs. It's something that basically never really goes away. And so I think from an industry standpoint, we acknowledge that the money needs to be paid. We need to have licenses. We just want to make sure that even though I don't have a choice in paying it, there should be make sure that I should have at least some protection from some of the abuses that might happen in those situations. So I think, you know, not speaking for everybody involved in it, seems like the bill is very close to where we need to be. I appreciate all the work that that everybody has done on this, both the PROs and the people inside the building. So we appreciate it, but that's kind of where we're at. So,
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Dan Bates, representing the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. We are one of those PROs, and there are a number of us. And I appreciate the work of the chairman in putting this together, as well as our colleagues at BMI, who are another PRO that have been working on this in the building, Bill, and then the wine growers. We actually came to agreement on the legislation in the last session, but not in time for the deadline. And so what you have before you is our understanding, I think, accurately of what that agreement was, and we feel good about where it's going. The American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers holds its folks to the highest standards. The standards are in this bill, we believe, are very easy for us to comply with. We try and train folks. We try and engage with the different associations on how to interact with their members. There are other societies that are not BMI and ASCAP, and so we're happy to have these codes of conduct in the statute. The last time this was looked at was about 20 years ago. I think a lot of these changes come from a recent update up in Washington. We're pleased to be supportive of the consensus draft that you have in front of us, and don't want to see the activity that Bill has described occur, and do everything we can to make sure it doesn't happen. Happy to answer any questions.
Great. Any questions on this one? Not seeing any. Thank you for presenting the issue and the LC concept that will be turning into a committee bill here shortly, hopefully. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Okay,
thank you.
And I know that Dan Jarman also wanted to be here because he's also been in this conversation but wasn't able to be. So thank you, Bill Perry, for stepping up. Committee, next there's a few other concepts to talk about, bringing forward from members. Just going to take a quick little prerogative and talk about, why don't we go to Representative Bynum? She can talk about hers. I'm not ready yet.
Oh, sweet point to me.
Can I also ask Brian Creek to come up with
you? Certainly.
Thank you.
You can if you can find him.
Oh, there
it is. Brian Krieg.
There we go.
He knew he was on.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Representative Janelle Bynum for the record. I have LC 131, and it deals with minority women-owned business and service-disabled veterans. And it's essentially a program cap lift. I'll just read the background to make it very simple, and then if you have super technical questions, I'll bounce it to this guy. So many local governments have started setting aspirational goals on their construction projects for utilization of disadvantaged minority or women-owned firms. And these general contractors hire these subcontractor firms to meet their goals. The definition of the firms is set by the federal government, but there's also the state has an interest in setting those goals as well. So what is happening is that the firms are capping out. They're doing really well. But we want to be able to retain and grow more contractors. So this will allow them to keep their status and grow and mentor new subcontractors into the business. So LC 131 allows DBE firms who have graduated from the program due only to hitting the gross receipts cap to be still counted as a DBE subcontractor for purposes of aspirational goals on public construction projects if they're willing to assist in the development of more DBE firms. To encourage growth of other minority or women-owned businesses, the graduate DBE firm would be required to subcontract out 20% of their work to other DBE firms and provide mentorship. Some of the pocket mentoring expenses would be paid for out of a small technical assistance fund that a local government has set up as part of the contract. So that's the summary.
Mr. Krieg, would you like to add anything?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I would just like to give a little bit of texture to this. And you heard about this earlier when we were talking about the shortage of contractors, the big construction boom we have going on. It's an unprecedented construction boom going on. And the issue is if we start graduating out some of our larger minority contractors, women-based contractors, out of the process, they've gotten large and they have a large amount of the workforce, and we don't have that big of a pipeline to fill behind them, and so our goals are basically kind of tripping each other up here, partly based on the fact that we have a raging construction market going on at the moment. And so it's causing some problems in the marketplace to try to match up all the goals. And we think that by having the larger ones who have graduated have some hands-on help a little bit to pull some more people through the pipeline, that could be a very good way to try and build a stronger, longer pipeline on that. So this is basically what we're trying to do, is just give some relief under specific circumstances if the contractor is so willing to even want to do that. And that will be something that they would, each contractor who had graduated out, would do. They still have to maintain all of the other standards of being, if it's like a woman-owned business, they still have to have all of those parameters in place. So.
If I can add, too, the governor's proposal was focused also on getting more contractors out in the rural areas. And so this also kind of matches with that. The more contractors we have, maybe the smaller contractors would be willing to go out into the rural areas and help build those projects. So it's all about getting more into the pipeline. So,
thank okay. you. That was a good overview of the issue, as I understand it. Appreciate that. Don't see any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Colleagues, I also have LC 221, which I'm bringing forward. I needed four committee bills. This relates to data breach issue that we talked about with after the impact from an Equifax data breach. And so we are bringing this bill forward to update the data breach and identity security issues. They haven't been looked at for, I believe, 10 years or so. And it's hard to think that we've had so many changes in information security and data security and hacking and now more data breach issues. It was overdue to address some of these statutes and also taking a special look at how we can help consumers navigate this and recover from some of the harm. And also help the businesses, quite frankly, to move forward and try to fine-tune and actually streamline these processes to get this done quicker, because the longer it takes to identify these data breaches and deal with them, the more expensive they are and the more it costs, especially our financial industry, who bears oftentimes a brunt of the cost of correcting some of the data breach issues. So the concept does do that. It talks about making some free credit freezes available to folks. Currently, right now, it costs $10 to put a credit freeze on. And, of course, you need to do that with three different agencies, credit reporting agencies. So if you want to freeze your credit right now in Oregon, it costs $30, $30. And some states have got free credit freezes available. So we're trying to address that issue, certainly. We're also trying to address the statutes around the obligation to notification of data breaches to the financial industry, to the merchants, and consumers as well. So those are a couple of main pieces of the bill. There's also a little section that's going to put a restriction on what's called upselling. When you're a victim in one of these data breach scenarios, oftentimes the company will offer you a free service to help you do something, and then they upsell further monitoring service that sometimes it's very difficult to know that your free service is actually going to have ongoing costs later on. And so we're trying to address some practices around that. And certainly we do have a piece that also, does enhance some of the Attorney General participation in this. And we also are looking at a piece that would enable the public to bring a civil action forward, which is a relatively new concept. There are some examples around the country of that, but it does enable the consumer to actually get a remedy in certain circumstances. And that, I think, sort of sums up the concept a little bit. Ms. Norland has been helping me with that project, so thank you. But that's a big issue this session. I think most of the issues we're hearing in this committee are going to be big issues, and some bigger than others. But this with the three other concepts that are committee bills, this concept were all issues that we were brought up during the last session that we didn't quite deal with. So in the short session, we're sort of trying to finish up business from last session. So that's LC 221. And I'm not sure, are there any other members that want to speak? Representative Fahey.
Yeah. Well, while she's going down, can I ask you a quick question about the data breach one?
You can try.
Okay.
I was concerned. And I can try and answer.
I was concerned about biometric data. Uh-huh. So I will probably, that may be a consideration for 19, but I mean, now you can pay with your fingerprint through Apple Pay, mm-hmm. and that's
that. And I will say that we've had a work group on this okay. issue, and that topic has come up.
Okay. I'm satisfied.
We are currently working on an amendment on LC 221, and okay. there's also another vehicle on the Senate side, LC 204, that Senator Prozanski is bringing forward. Okay. So we've sort of had a joint work group on this issue, and that concept has come up. I'm trying to remember. I'll just have to get back to you what we ended up doing with that piece.
Okay.
Don't know. Or don't remember is probably a better answer. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, I'm Julie Fahey, State Representative for West Eugene and Junction City. So I wanted to take just a few minutes to talk about one of the bills I'm working on for the short session on wage payment accountability. So as we've heard in this committee before, the construction industry has one of the highest rates of payment noncompliance for wages. So when workers aren't paid what they're earned, it can be a big financial hit for them and their families, and it can hit the local economy as well. Under current law, if a subcontractor doesn't pay the wages or they owe to a worker or their fringe benefit payments, then the worker is able to access the bond of a general contractor. If the general contractor can't pay from their bond, then potentially something like a lien could be put on the project property. This current process to try to access unpaid wages and unpaid benefits payments can take up to 6 years for wages and up to a year in the case of benefit payments. And most workers can't afford to wait that long. So unfortunately, we've heard a number of examples of where the current process for trying to get these unpaid wages and benefits paid by a subcontractor isn't working. In one example, a subcontractor didn't pay the full wages and benefits owed and then went bankrupt. And after a lengthy proceedings in bankruptcy court and in state circuit court, there was a lien filed on the property that was finally foreclosed on after 2 years, and the payments were made. In another example, a private subcontractor employed laborers on a public works job but didn't pay them the contracted fringe benefit payments. They were sued, but when the judgment was made a year later, the subcontractor had no assets, so the benefits still haven't been paid after about a year and a half. So what LC 235 would do is it would bring the liability for unpaid wages and benefit payments up to the general contractor for the construction project. So if a sub had unpaid wages and benefits, the general would ultimately be liable. That approach acknowledges that the people who have the greatest benefit and the greatest responsibility for a project also have a duty to ensure that workers are being paid on that project. The bill wouldn't make a general contractor liable for any penalties assessed against the sub, and it wouldn't create a new private right of action for individual workers against the general contractor. Our intention is also that the bill would allow general contractors to withhold payments from the subcontractor if there are disputed unpaid wage claims. It's a sort of technical bill, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to preview it, but my hope is that the bill will both make it easier for workers to be paid what they're owed and, almost more importantly, will incentivize general contractors to hire responsible subcontractors. It will also help responsible businesses, the folks who are doing the right thing, who we don't want to penalize, because it will make it more likely that the general contractors will hire them. The concept is still in Legislative Council getting a few revisions, but I do appreciate getting a few minutes to chat about it today.
Thank you. And I do know that's a challenging area, so appreciate you taking this on. So look forward to seeing the concept.
Thanks.
Was there any other members that felt compelled to talk about a legislative concept that they have that may be coming to this committee? Seeing any. So with that, I think we're done with our informational portion of the meeting, so I'm going to close the informational meeting. And I'd like to open a work session for the introduction of committee legislative concepts.
Chair Holvey, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 209, dated January 3rd, 2018, LC 211, dated December 21st, 2017, and LC 213, dated January 10th, 2018.
Representative Barreto moves that LC 209, LC 211, and LC 213 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Colleagues, I'll just remind you that your affirmative vote to introduce these as committee bills doesn't indicate any your support of these measures. It just allows us to bring these concepts forward for discussion in the February session. So if there is no further discussion, I think I'll do a. Is there any objection? Not. No objection. Then the motion passes, and the measures are introduced as committee bills. And Jan, I think that looks like the end of my agenda. Do you have anything on yours?
I don't. Nope, that's it.
All right. With that, thank you very much, committee, for being here on a Friday afternoon. And you have questions or want to, engage with me during this interim before session to ask questions about some of these concepts, I'll try to provide you as much information as I can. I'm not sure I can answer quite everything at this point, but stay engaged, and I guess we'll see you back here in February. With that, I will adjourn the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor.